and welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, today, what are we talking about today, Jem?
Yeah, after being recently rudely interrupted about suddenly talking about other podcasts, this time round, we're talking about...
Actually, Jem, let me just stop you. No, sorry, carry on, Jem.
Gregory!
It's going to be wonderful if we put these podcasts out in the wrong order and nobody knows what that means at all.
Yeah, remember, note to self. Anyway, armor. We're doing armor. That covers pretty much the whole of history because armor is a really interesting topic. You're trying to defend yourself from harm in war is about as old as war itself.
And when we're talking about armor, are we talking specifically about clothing, or are we going to bring in other things? You know, would a shield count as armor, or are we strictly talking about things you wear to defend yourself?
Oh, I would happily put both together. And, you know, it seems, you know, nobody knows because nobody had video in those days, but it seems the shield was the very first form of armor. Having a protective blocking thing from pointy spears seems pretty logical. But even the history of the shield has developed over 10,000 years, possibly longer. To give you an idea, when we get to the Battle of Thermopylae, the 300 Spartans plus the 2,000 other Greeks in the area versus the Persian hordes. What was interesting there is the Greek hoplites were very heavily armoured. This is the Bronze Age. So
that was the one with the greatest warrior king of all time, King Leonidas. That's the one, isn't it?
He's overrated. But anyway, no. So the point is the Greeks would stand in a phalanx formation. What does that mean? It means you had a great big spear sticking out for your in front of you, but your body was, which was already covered in like a breastplate of bronze, and you wore a bronze helmet and bronze leg guards and greaves, so your arms and legs covered as well. So all of that, although interestingly, no shoes, but anyway. But you also had a huge circular bronze-plated shield. It was wooden in the core. I mean, a solid bronze shield would be too heavy to carry. But when you consider there's a row of people like that, and they've got their shields, they've got their spears thrust out, and then the guys immediately behind them, they feed their spears through. So you've got this almost like porcupine, this hedgehog situation where even if you push past one spear, there's another spear there, and eventually you've got to try and get to the guy who's behind all that armor. The Thermopylae, the gates of Thermopylae were very, very narrow and the perfect place to put that kind of formation. Whereas, and I've always found this weird, until you start breaking it down, the Persians had very light armor and their shields, most of their shields were made out of wicker. And you're going to go, that is the worst form of defense as a shield. And in a way, you're right. And it was completely inadequate to fighting a Greek phalanx formation. They could just push their spears through the wicker. But actually, when you think about where the Persians tended to fight, they had to worry an awful lot with archers, and what wicker was very good as was at least entangling bows and the arrows. So they were very good against archer attack, and they could take a blow perhaps from a glancing blow from a blade of some description, but being pushed up against the armor-plated juggernaut that was the phalanx, the Greek phalanx, they just pushed straight through that soft armor, and they weren't really wearing anything else apart from their clothes. So yeah, that's why such a heavily outnumbered army lasted for 3 days and had to be sort of surrounded themselves before a vastly superior force in terms of numbers could win the day. There's an example of how armor was pivotal to a victory / defeat.
And I think one of the things you have to remember with shields is a shield is not purely defensive. I don't think I've told this story in the podcast before.
Go on.
I was actually sat around at one of the medieval festivals I was performing at probably 3 or 4 years ago now, and we were all sitting around the fire in the evening, and the area we'd actually got within this park, there's a couple of security guards wandering around, but there was also a group of yobs that went by on the other side of the river and decided to just start shouting stuff out. You know, sort of these silly lads, they shouted stuff out, they kept going, you know, they'd obviously got the wrong impression about how to have fun on a Saturday evening. We're all sitting around the fire having... And then it came down to the discussion, we all started to discuss, well, hang on, what would you do if these yobs come back in the middle of the night and they sort of burst into the encampment and started to really try and cause some trouble, you know. And we're sitting around saying, well, you know, this is a reenactor's circle, including me. You know, they have a lot of reenactment weapons around them. And they all kind of said, but yeah. But the thing is, if, you know, someone comes in and starts smashing up our stuff, and we turn around and we grab our sword, our mace, our, you know, anything else, and we rush outside with it, guess what? We're breaking the law. We're not allowed to go out there. We're not allowed to go out and just start attacking people with... And eventually this discussion came around to somebody who sat there very wisely and said, I would grab my shield. I would grab my shield because, remember, a shield is a weapon. It's this great big heavy piece of wood and metal, and it was used in battle as not just a defensive thing, but also as a form of a battering ram, as a club, all sorts of different things. And he worked on the theory that if someone came in and you went out and you gave them a quick tap with the shield, they would leave. And if the law turned up later and you started to get in trouble, you just turn around and say, I grabbed a shield. It's defensive. Look at all the weapons that I didn't take with me. And that kind of opened up to me the idea of the shield and the idea of armor. The fact that when we think about armor, a lot of the time it wasn't purely defensive. It also had this this offensive side to it, and shields and armor and everything else, they were not just defense, they were also weapons. But just to carry on with one other point that rose up from what you said there about the wicker shields, because obviously when we're looking at armor through history, there is this constant balancing act to be done when we come to armor. I do a Roman show that I do in schools. I was actually up doing it in Russell Moyer a couple of weeks ago, where I wear this Greco-Roman metal plate body armor and a metal helmet that is heavy and my view is restricted. I wear it for the hour. If I do two shows in a row, I really am quite knackered. It's got this wonderful sense. It gives a lovely loud clang if it gets hit. So it's great for the shows. But I have often considered swapping that for some light leather armour. And this was always one of the things they would have had when you're dealing with trying to decide what armour to equip your troops with. Do you want the strongest, heaviest, solidest armour you can possibly get so that they can stand there and take blows all day? Or do you go with something that's a bit lighter, doesn't offer quite as much defence, but at the same time allows your troops to actually move? Because if your troops can't move, it's no good having them having the best armor in the world if they can't actually fight in it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And but it's interesting when you were talking there about the shield as a weapon. Now, there was and we have a number of medieval manuals about how to fight, and the general consensus is that if for some reason somebody disarms you, and so you have a choice to either do you grab your shield, do you grab a sword? You grab the shield every time. There's no debate about it, because yes, you can defend with it. You can, yeah, you can use it as a battering ram, but just the edge of it, you know, if you can slam that into somebody, you'll know about that pretty well. And the, so if we're going to continue the armor and then the sort of the heavy armor of the Middle Ages, the full plate mail armor, once somebody's encased with that, and it weighed between sort of 40, 50 pounds weight. The other thing that's worth mentioning about that is it was obviously eye-wateringly expensive, and it was designed for each person. When people say about Richard III, it's like, oh, I mean, obviously we've now got his body, but for a while it was like, oh, could he really have had a hunchback? Because how on earth could he have had worn armor at the Battle of Bosworth? And it's like, do you not understand that armor is bespoke? So if he did have a bent spine, which it turns out we now know he did, they just build the armor to go round it. That's not a problem for the technology of the time. But when somebody is basically covered in steel, hitting them with a sword isn't going to do anything. It's just going to glance off the steel. It's not going to cause any damage. So actually, when you look at late medieval weapons, it tends to be things like maces, war hammers, sort of things like pickaxes almost, battle axes as well, because it was just a heavy metal thing on the end of a wooden handle. So if you swung it, even if it didn't cut through the armor, you could still concuss somebody with it. So it was actually almost like bludgeoning tools. But you're quite right. You know, well done. I can no longer really be hurt by most people, but you're now far more cumbersome. And at the Battle of Agincourt, it's interesting to note that, so obviously the archers did their bit with the longbows, and they clearly had armor-piercing arrows, which interestingly looked different. Everybody, when they think about arrows, think about the arrowheads, the triangular arrowheads. That isn't going to pierce armor. When you look at armor-piercing longbow arrows, their heads are what looks like basically a nail. It's a 6-inch steel spike, and that's just obviously designed to just puncture through the armor and get the man inside. But some of the French knights at the Battle of Agincourt drowned in the mud because they were so immobilized by the sticky mud in their heavy armor that they drowned in mud, which is about as a disgusting way to go as possible. And just one last thing on this, the English peasants at that time, they would have something called, how do I put this politely? I'm going to mispronounce it, but a billock knife. And it's a very thin, long knife. And so the idea was, again, you know, if they're lucky enough to run up to a French nobleman who's lying there on his back in the armor and can't get up again, well, he hasn't got anything that can really kill the guy unless you've got this thin, narrow knife, which you can jam into the visor. So you just keep stabbing it into the guy's face until he stops wriggling. Nice. So all of that is, you know, so it changes how the weapons looked, it changed how the warfare took place, and all of that is to do with the armor design of the time.
And when you're talking about arrows and things like that, you don't actually need always the biggest, bulkiest armor for the best defense. I think it's Attila the Hun who, and the Mongol hordes, who had this incredible armor against the arrows of the time, which came down to purely a silk shirt. And I know various other people kind of use the same idea. You'd wrap silk around shields and things. But a silk shirt has this incredible defense, particularly against those nasty barbed arrows you get, the ones that spike out of the back. So when they go into a person, the idea is, yes, you hit the person with the arrow goes in, but what really causes the damage is trying to get it out again, because it barbs outwards. And the idea of a silk shirt being worn either instead of armor or actually as, instead of armor or even under armor is the fact that if you're wearing a silk shirt, silk is incredibly strong. It won't stop the arrow going in, but what it will do is it will stretch. It won't actually tear. And the idea with that was that the arrow would actually go into a person. You can then gently stretch the shirt around the wound and the arrow will pop out without tearing as it comes out. And so even something quite simple like a silk shirt, it's light, it's simple, it's expensive, but it's a piece of armor that could be worn, could be used to assist, and it deals with another problem. So that's the other thing, is you have to look at, well, what weapons are we being attacked by, and how does our armor best protect us against that particular type of weapon? And that's where we then come into what you were saying at the beginning of the episode about the 300. It's absolutely fine to have the best armor until you find yourself being attacked by somebody that isn't playing by the same rules as you are. We've seen that over and over again in history. The Romans going into Britain, where they suddenly found themselves having guerrilla warfare among the woods. Their armor was designed. They had all these wonderful formations. They had this wonderful armor. They had these incredible shields, all of this stuff. But once they got into the woods and they were attacked by the Celts using guerrilla tactics, the Romans couldn't move fast enough in those confined spaces. In the confined space of a wood, Roman armor is not what you want. You want to be much lighter. You want to be much quicker. And so it really does come down to choosing the right armor, not just the best armor available, but also the best armor for a particular type of battle as well.
Ladies and gentlemen, What you've just had there is, if you know this podcast, Jem likes to go obscure and quite often to the east. Greg got there first. And I can actually add a few bits about that. The thing about this silk cloth, everything you've just said, absolutely true. It was more effective when it was underneath leather armor. Leather armor is still comparatively light. And that's an early example of composite armor. This idea that different layers can actually make of stronger than the whole, as it were, that worked really, really well. However, it's one of these examples where the theory sound, the reality isn't, because, and you're quite right, Genghis Khan did actually sort of get thousands of these shirts and give them to his warriors. But it turned out that when you're riding around for 3 months, you don't have time to wash. And so these silk shirts degraded, they became really grubby. And for the amount of being able to sort of tighten the silk to pull out the arrow, while that was a thing, the silk shirt itself was so dirty and disgusting that wounds were getting infected anyway. So it was a nice idea, didn't quite work, but it does lead me on to the weirdest form of armor from Asia. Greg, quick question for you. How would you like, or how confident would you be going into war wearing paper armor?
Oh, this sounds interesting. I mean, if it was some sort of incredible origami, or I'll tell you what, I would go in wearing paper armor. I'm assuming the paper armor is sort of just a big piece of paper that says, "Please don't shoot me" on the front. No, I mean, well, I'm assuming you've got something more to this, but no, on the surface, I would say that wouldn't be my first choice.
No, but you could obviously understand that it would be lighter than any other form of armor and relatively cheap as well, particularly compared to metal armor. And what you've got actually in both Japan and China is they did have paper armor, but obviously it wasn't just a sheet of paper. Of course, all you have to do is look at a book and think about, do you know what, if somebody swung a kitchen knife at a book, just your average paperback, it's not going to go all the way through. Paper is actually quite dense. It led to, there's a recent court case, very sad court case. There was this boyfriend, girlfriend who wanted to create a viral video. You know, these silly little videos that just catch the imagination, get millions of hits, and then everybody moves on. They were going to earn some advertising revenue. So this man, I shouldn't laugh, this man managed to convince his girlfriend to fire a gun through this thick book to show how it would stop a bullet. And indeed, there are certain many cases where that happened. But they hadn't tested it properly, so when she fired it, it went through the book and killed him. So she ended up going to prison for 6 months for manslaughter. Even though she killed somebody, it was what she could prove on the video is he was encouraging her to do so. She was reluctant to do it in the first place, but it was all his idea. And yeah, well, it didn't work out well for him. So, but that's a failed example of paper armor, if you like, but there are real examples of it. But the paper itself was, it was sheets of paper, but we're back to this composite idea, sort of sheets of paper layered on top of each other, and then critically, it was lacquered both on front and back. And when you did all that together, if I swung a sword at it, it would definitely absorb the blow. If I fired an arrow at it, it probably would glance off because it was sort of relative, sort of semi-circular, as it were. It gave everybody the look of a kind of a bulging pot belly, but if that deflects arrows, I don't care how I look. But if somebody was to perhaps do a lance from the back of a horse, that would absolutely penetrate it. But it was pretty surprisingly good armor at relatively low cost that was quite lightweight. The biggest problems were, and because it was lacquered, it was waterproof, but as soon as it took any kind of damage, it degraded the entire effectiveness of the armor. You know, if I take a swing at some steel armor plating and manage to chip it a bit, it doesn't really fundamentally make it brittle and it's about to collapse in on itself. But of course, if we're talking about paper and lacquer, once I've punctured it, the whole thing is more flexible and less rigid, and therefore it all falls to pieces. But an interesting solution to the problem of, fundamentally, what this is all about is I want to protect my troops so that they can keep on fighting. That's why armor exists. And of course, if you spent all that money on plate armor for everybody, you would go bankrupt. So you can't do that for everybody. And in Asia, they tended to have larger armies in battles than in the West. So therefore, I have to try and equip as many people as possible with relatively cheap but still effective armor.
And then you reach this point where suddenly armor starts to actually disappear. Because you talk there about shooting shooting into the book. And yes, we do have stories. There's definitely at least one book still around from World War One that I read about recently, with the, I believe, the bullets lodged 50 pages from the end of the book. But as you say, don't try this at home, because it's got to do with specific angles and specific type of guns over specific distances. Always reminds me when I hear these stories of people trying stuff like that, always reminds me of the bullet catch magic trick and all the people who've died performing that particular one, because it's so much can go wrong. But yeah, you can be protected by pieces of paper, but in general, for a person, until very recently, recent scientific advances have changed, but really from the sort of 1800s time, Napoleonic Wars really, we enter this period where you're fighting and people have got guns, and really you can wear slightly thicker jackets and things like that. But in general, we reach this point, especially coming into the First World War, where armour, sort of personal armour, starts to disappear in favour of uniform, because really there's not an armour that you could wear in World War One that's going to be effective against the sort of weaponry that you come up against at World War One. And this is something that everyone's pushing for now. You get Kevlar, you get flak jackets, you get all sorts of things, and the trouble is that it's like the arms race with everything else. Somebody then goes away and builds a bullet that will go straight through whatever type of armor you're wearing. But in the same way as sort of bombs and larger cannons, larger assault artillery weapons sort of saw the end of castles in a big way, do you think that with modern weapons and everything else, we've really reached the end of where personal armour is going in history? Because obviously we're now moving on to armoured vehicles and tanks and things like that.
Well, let's put aside things like mechanised, you know, because we did an episode on tanks and things like that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about personal armor, which is why I'll allow a shield, but I won't allow a tank. But actually, I would agree with you. And broadly speaking, from about 1700 to 1950, so let's call it 250 years, basically armies didn't wear armor. But in a way, they sort of did. So going back to World War One, at the beginning of World War One, British soldiers wore cloth caps, and the Germans wore the Pickelhaube, which was a leather cap with a spike on the top of it. And what both sides realize is when you have men crouched in trenches and you're using these aerial burst mortars, a lot of men were dying from head wounds. So there's no point covering their chest, because the detonation is above the human being. You just need something to cover up their head and maybe a little bit of their shoulders as well, which is where we get the Brodie helmet. That's the actual name of that sort of signature British helmet that was worn in both World War One and World War Two. But that only came into World War One after about a year and a half of fighting, as the command realized they needed to do something to protect the men in the trenches from aerial attack. Another example of how the generals were actually trying to save lives and do the right thing. And there were examples of novel heavy plate armor for people to wear and perhaps use to sort of push, be at the front of the firing to get to the enemy. But the problem with it, as you were saying, is it was so heavy, because to stop a sort of 303 caliber rifle shot from a Lee Enfield, it had to be better than medieval armor as well. And so if you're wearing something that heavy, you're going to tire quite quickly. You're going to find it hard to fight in combat. So in hand-to-hand combat, I should say. So, the other problem on top of all those things is you're now talking about quite literally millions of men fighting. We can't give millions of men full body armor. That's not a thing that any economy can sustain. But since the Korean War, you know, even when we get to Vietnam, there were flak jackets being worn by the American soldiers, and obviously they were wearing helmets too. But kind of from that point onwards, we're not talking about millions of men in combat anymore. We're usually talking about tens of thousands or a few hundred thousand. And in a modern economy, yes, we've now got Kevlar jackets. And going all the way back to the shield, I find it interesting that you've now got things like tactical squads like SWAT teams, and they have ballistic shields, which are these sort of armor-plated composite shields, which they can hide behind, and they are quite bulky, but they'll stop pretty much anything short of a grenade round being fired at them. But they have a little slit of ballistic glass there, so I can literally look through the shield and perhaps stick my handgun around the side and shoot you while you can't hit me. But it's showing you how, right now in 2018, shields are still a legitimate military tactic to use in combat, and yet they were also equally important 3,000 years ago. So, you know, protecting the human form just doesn't go away, but you do absolutely have this huge gap of centuries where people, particularly cultures that traditionally clad their soldiers in armor, didn't do it, and is one of the reasons why you have such incredibly high casualty rates. It's not just because of the weapons being used, it's also because of the lack of protection that the men were wearing.
And I think we're just about running out of time, so we're going to have to sort of wrap the podcast up. There, one more piece of armor that I just wanted to bring up, sort of from within that period where people didn't wear armor, and just to sort of show that people were constantly trying. One of the most interesting pieces of armors, with quite a sad story surrounding it, is Ned Kelly's armor.
Oh, yes.
Which, when we're talking in the world of bullets and armor, Ned Kelly, for those of you who haven't heard of him, very, very famous Australian outlaw, he actually, in his final battle with the police, he actually hand-built a suit of armor, or he had a homemade suit of armor made out of old plow blades and things like that, which he actually went out against the police in. He wasn't shot to death. It actually was successful enough that he was arrested. The armor was taken by the police as a souvenir and can now be seen in a museum. But it's interesting when you say about shields dating back and we try and repurpose these things. If you look at it, Ned Kelly's armor does look very like an old medieval suit of plate armor repurposed. So it's somebody that's taking an idea of old-fashioned armor and just thinking, well, I'll just make it a bit thicker and hope that it works against guns. Unfortunately, it also made it incredibly unwieldy and, you know, made it possible for him to be caught. But that was just my final piece of armor. That was one more to squeeze in for you to go and look at that we didn't have time to fit in the podcast. Jim, we're just about ready to finish up. So if you're ready, do you have a plug this week?
I'm going to say books. I've written a whole bunch of books, 9 at the moment, 7 published, 2 self-published. So go onto Amazon or go into Waterstones or go wherever and perhaps ask for Jem Deducciu's books or have a look at what I've written. There's got to be something there for everybody. But there's a nice long selection. Napoleonic Wars, Ottoman Empire, Roman Empire, the Crusades, come on, something there's got to tickle your fancy, and a lot more.
And I'm going to say The Last Airship, which is my steampunk web series, that's still available for you to watch. If you go to The Last Airship Facebook page or www.thelastairship.com, you can find out about it, and do keep your eyes peeled because there are some new mini videos coming out. And I have recently started a Patreon page, or restarted that, which is how I'm going to be funding Series 2. So I'll make announcements and talk about that in the future, I've no doubt. But you can go and check that out. But for now, go to The Last Airship Facebook page and see some of the new videos, which will probably be up by the time this episode comes out. Also, don't forget, both me and Jem have our own podcast as well as this one. You've got Jem's podcast Neon, you've got my Greg Chapman's Tales from the Road, and you've got the Condensed Histories Jem podcast, and all three of those are available on all good podcasting apps. And if you can just take a few moments out of your day to go and just write a little review for any one of the three or all three of them, that would be really, really appreciated. It helps us get our work known about as well. But for now, I think it's time to say a very big thank you to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducciu.
And to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And thank you all very much for listening. For now, goodbye and take care.